Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. This episode, I'm talking to Chris Dickman. Chris is the ecologist responsible for the biggest news story during the bushfires. His estimates of 1 billion animals killed or injured went absolutely viral. It drew even more international focus to the devastation of these recent bushfires. So I'm really excited to be talking to Chris today on this episode of Talking Australia. Chris, thanks so much for hanging out with me today.
My pleasure.
Now, approximately 11 million hectares have burned in Australia so far, and you came out with the estimate that something like 800 million animals had been affected by these bushfires, and that's just in New South Wales. And then you said basically 1 billion animals across Australia had been affected by the bushfires. Those are such alarming statistics, first of all. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got to those numbers?
Sure. So the numbers came from an earlier study carried out in 2007 when a group of us were concerned about the effects of land clearing, legally approved land clearing in New South Wales. And at that time, the state government, between 1998 and 2005, had approved 640,000 hectares of land to be cleared in New South Wales. We knew it was a lot more than that because of all the illegal clearing and all the other various pieces of legislation that allow people to excise bits of land and chop them down without any constraint. But 640,000 was what the government had legally approved under the legislation at the time. We wanted to know how many animals that was likely to have affected. In the case of land clearing, it pretty much kills them either immediately or they might move to other habitats and then die later on from starvation or being evicted. To get the estimates, we looked at all the published and unpublished work that we could find, unpublished work from PhD theses and so on, from our own field observations, put all of the information together, and then got average density estimates for the different mammal groups, so for animals like the koala, the echidna, the possums, the gliders, the native rodents, and so on, and got the average densities for the areas that were being cleared in different habitats in New South Wales. When you know the average number of animals per hectare, you can simply multiply the number of hectares that's been approved for clearing to get the number that will have been killed. So that number for the 2007 study ended up being 104 million. For the bushfires, we applied exactly the same methodology, same density estimates. The areas that were approved for land clearing were, in many cases, the same areas that are being burned at the moment. Not the same bits of land, because areas that are being cleared and built on won't burn. But using the same density estimates for the same habitats, you can multiply the areas covered by the fires by the densities of animals they contain. And the initial estimate was 480 million when 3 million hectares of forest estate are burned in New South Wales. When the fires burnt 5 million, that estimate went up to 800 million native mammals, birds and reptiles. And then we thought, well, there have been big fires in Victoria just over the border in habitats that are pretty similar to those in New South Wales for which we have density estimates. It's reasonable to extrapolate and add on the area burned in Victoria to get the additional number of animals that will have been killed. That number was over 1 billion.
And when you made those estimates and they were released, did you expect them to go just as far as they did because it went completely viral?
I thought it might make a little bit of a splash, perhaps in Australia, but the international attention has been so intense. It's I think since the 3rd of January, when the estimates were first picked up in the UK, I've probably given over 100 interviews.
Oh, wow.
And that's for print, for TV, for radio, for social media, podcasts and so on. So that's been, it's been fantastic in the sense that it's now shone a spotlight on the whole problem that's faced not just by people and the communities in the line of the bushfires, but everything that lives in the habitat as well.
Mm.
And that's been perhaps the one beneficial thing to come out of this. We're now looking very hard at best practice management for the forests.
Mm. And what do you, in terms of the animals included in those numbers and the animals more generally affected by the bushfires, what animals from your perception, from your perspective as an ecologist, are you most worried about?
It's probably the, well, there are, I guess there are different points of view. As an ecologist, you're more worried about the integrity of populations, where they're going to persist, whether the species is likely to go as a consequence of the fires. You're worried about the habitat and about all the ecological processes that go. So you're, I guess, concerned across the board about the integrity of the environments that are burning and whether they'll come back in next year or in 100 years in anything approaching the state that they were in before the fire. In some cases, I think we can say that they won't be coming back in anything like that state, simply because really important key species will have been removed. From, I guess, a more individualistic point of view, it's just terrible seeing some of the images of burned koalas and burned kangaroos and animals trying to flee in panic in front of the fire front.
Mm. And I guess koalas have been, or the images of the koalas have been the most kind of shocking to international audiences as well. But what are some of the lesser known animals that are really important ecologically that maybe don't get as much attention?
Living with the koala, you'll usually find a variety of species of possums and gliders, including animals like the greater glider. It's a species that occurs with the koala in many situations. It really likes tall, dense forests, and it's an even more specialist eucalyptus leaf eater than the koala. And it's quite likely that their populations have really taken a hit in the fires. From an ecological importance point of view, we're probably looking at species that carry out functions such as moving seeds around, moving fungal spores that assist with plant regrowth and regeneration, species that dig in the topsoil to ensure that there's continued nutrient cycling, that organic material gets buried, water infiltrates when it rains. Some of the species that are important in that regard would be, I'll take the flying foxes. The grey-headed flying foxes are well known for a variety of reasons. One, because they're beautiful and charismatic animals that hang about in huge numbers that are just wondrous to behold. They're not particularly liked by the orchard industry because they do get into fruit. But from an ecological point of view, they're really important as pollinators. They stick their heads into flowers and visit other flowers after a first feed, looking for pollen and nectar.
I have to say, one of my favourite images is seeing a flying fox among all those blossoms. It's so beautiful. Oh,
that's right. And if you go to Centennial Park and look at the colony there, in the day, it's just fantastic. They're all up there. You can see them, you can hear them, you can smell them from some distance away, and it's just standing underneath and watching these animals is just fantastic.
And talking about the flying fox and koalas and other types of, even the greater glider, they were under pressure prior to these bushfires. So I'm wondering if you could kind of speak to that and how, what was their situation prior to, and, you know, what's been the impact of the bushfires now in terms of worsening that situation?
Yeah, we've got probably good information on the flying foxes, the spectacled flying fox, Queensland, the grey-headed flying fox in New South Wales. We know that on really hot days following the prolonged drought in 2019, animals were simply dropping out of the trees dead. They can't cope with temperatures of 41, 42 degrees and more, certainly not for days at a time. So their populations were depleting. Not only were animals dying, but reproduction was being compromised. And so populations were really on a sharp downward slide even before the fires started. And the animals that were around, that had survived until the fire season, would have been probably quite stressed by the fact that they'd been under food and water stress for so long, and then being hit by the bushfires as well. It's a real double whammy. So because of the ecological importance of flying foxes in helping to regenerate forests by their movement of pollen, their movement of seeds from place to place, if we are to lose them in big numbers, as we seem to be doing, the ability of many of our forest environments, particularly littoral rainforests on the coast, is going to be really badly compromised.
And I feel like a lot of the arguments I've seen made by different people are, oh, you know, Australian animals, they can cope with this. They're made to kind of live alongside fire. This is very natural. But obviously you mentioned, yeah, rainforests where fires have never really gone before. What do you predict for those sorts of scenarios?
Yeah, I think for the idea that certainly fires have occurred for many thousands of years in the Australian environment, and both the plants and the animals and the ecosystems generally are fairly well adapted in many areas to fire, to the point where many species are actually dependent on fire. The problem is that when you get fire that's too frequent or too severe or covers too large an area, you don't necessarily get the chance for a lot of individuals to survive. And in the situation that we've created, where we've chopped the forests up to a large degree, so there's a lot of fragmented forest, particularly on the coastal areas, where people have built roads, there's agriculture, there are housing developments everywhere. The forests are now fragmented. If you have a fire that goes through any of these blocks, it's much harder for animals to recolonise after the fire has gone through. They've simply got to cross vast tracts of houses, roads, other habitat that really is inimical to their survival.
And can you take me through why these fires are unprecedented?
It's a consequence of the very long, prolonged drought in 2019 and even before that, and then the very hot conditions that prevailed around the time the fires kicked off. So when you've got heatwave conditions and you've got a very dry and extensive area of bush, it's going to be, well, it's like a tinderbox ready to go up. So any accidental fires from stupid people really throwing cigarette butts out of their car window, dry lightning strikes, it's just going to take off. And I think that's what we've seen. And these effects were predicted. It's not as if they should be completely unexpected by the community.
I actually want to go into that because I know that a number of ecologists have written brought out statements that kind of talk about the studies that they had written, you know, X amount of years ago, decades ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago about these predictions. How do you feel kind of, you know, reflecting on all those predictions that the science community has made and then being in this situation regardless?
I think there's a feeling of real despondency in the ecological community. There's probably a feeling of failure that we've had all of this information. We've tried our best to put it out there to the broader public and it's just either been ignored or swept under the carpet. And at the government level, it's been progressively defunded simply because what ecologists are saying are messages that they don't want to hear. So there's people have been really writing about this and talking about it. It's just been so difficult to get it out to a broader audience. There's one specific example at the beginning of 2019, following the New South Wales state government's change of legislation in 2016, scrapping what had been some fairly effective environmental legislation, an act called the Biodiversity Conservation Act was put into place. The provisions started to kick in 2017. And although pretty much anybody in the ecological sphere had been warning that the Act was pretty much designed to allow land clearing to take off again, that was ignored, and what we've seen is that land clearing has taken off. It's tripled in New South Wales in areas that have been studied. And that was clearly a consequence of that legislation, an intended consequence too. It's, I think we have to say. In early 2019, Andrea Griffin and Martine Maron and other people put together a one-page statement that said that land clearing is out of control again. We really need it. It's absolutely excessive. We need to try to come back to some sort of balance with the environment. 400 scientists, ecologists, environmental scientists, signed this document. It was sent to as many politicians, media outlets that we could think of, and it got zero pickup.
Wow.
So that's the sense of frustration. And it was, I think, early in 2019, when conditions were already drying out, we could see that there was going to be something likely to happen if it didn't rain. And it was this initiative was completely ignored.
We'll be back with our conversation with Chris Dickman in just a moment. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We are back with our conversation with Chris Dickman.
And I guess this is the question of the 21st century. Why is it, or why has that trust in scientists and ecologists like yourself broken down the way it has? Because something like that maybe 20 years ago would have had more of a, or maybe even this started 20 years ago, but what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think ecologists are carrying a message that the powers that be don't like to hear, so it's suppressed. People don't want to hear that they might have to make changes to their lifestyle to accommodate the natural environment, even though we all depend on the natural environment. So it's a two-way thing. But I think the corporations, the people who are running the show don't really care, and they go out of their way in many cases to make sure that negative information doesn't get out. If it can't be suppressed, then you sow the seeds of doubt, and we've seen that so vividly with climate change. There's one example that, or an analogy perhaps, that we don't question medical advice. Let's say you wake up one morning and you find you've got a huge growth on the side of your head. So you go to your GP and the GP says, "That's absolutely terrible. It's got to come off straight away." Yeah, I'll go and see somebody else. So you go and visit 99 GPs and specialists, and they all tell you the same thing. "That's terrible. It's going to kill you. Get it off immediately." Then you go to number 100, and number 100 says, "Ah, that's okay. You don't need to worry about that. Let it go." And you come away thinking, "Oh, that's relief. I'm okay then." And you've ignored the 99 other GPs and specialists. And that's exactly what it is for climate change. In fact, it's more extreme. 999 climate scientists out of 1,000 will tell you that we've got a real problem now. We've got to act. And yet, society at large, and certainly our political leaders, corporations, and many others over the years have said, "No, we'll go with the 1% or the 0.1% because that's the message we want to hear."
Do you think the role of scientists has kind of changed in the public sphere in the sense that now they're seen as public figures, they're more likely to write op-eds, they're more, they have to change the way maybe typically they used to operate in that things were published in academic papers and then shared amongst peers, but I guess now the pressure is to really push stuff out there. How has that kind of changed?
I think it certainly has changed. In the past, you'd get some funding, you'd carry out the research, you'd publish it in a journal, and it would probably be read by three people and sit on the shelf forevermore. Now you realise that, particularly with publicly funded research, there's a responsibility to get the information out to as wide an audience as possible. And it means publishing the data in open access sources. It means getting the information out there through social media, through whatever outlets you can, to make sure that the information is out there. And that does mean modifying the language to not dumb it down, but just to make sure that the central message is there with the appropriate caveats. And I think the key thing is that when speaking out, you need to have the evidence base behind you. And that's really crucial. And I think if people are going to speak out, that's the key differentiating thing that has to be there. You have to have the evidence base behind you to know what you're talking about and to back it up at any point.
Mm. And on the topic of climate change and where we have to kind of go to prevent this from happening again or getting worse in the future, do you think we can recover from what's happened this season, and what do you think it will take going forward to prevent those types of situations? What do you want to see post-bushfire?
I think it's going to take a really big effort across the board to try to ensure that we get back to something that approximates what was there before the fires went through. Certainly some communities won't recover because they will have lost species that are crucial for their functioning. With the loss of biodiversity, of course, you can't get back. Once an extinction happens, then, yeah, those species won't be recovered at any time in the future. But in general, there will be a recovery of ecological systems. Many of the forest environments that have burned, if they haven't burned too severely, the trees will re-sprout. They'll come back. There will be a reseeding, a restocking of the ground level vegetation. Grasses and herbs will come in first. Shrubs will come back later. And as the vegetation recovers, there will be a return by the animals that depend on the primary productivity. It might be that there'll be small areas of the landscape that have remained unburned, and they're probably the refuge areas from which species will begin to move out into the surrounding environment when it recovers. But I guess one of the longer-term consequences of the fires, perhaps, is that we know that a large chunk of the forest estate has burned this year. Mm-hmm. It's quite possible that with hot and very dry conditions next year or the year after, there will be large areas of forest that haven't burned this time round, burn at that time. And I think what we have to do is to try to maximise the opportunities afforded by the unburned parts of the landscape this time round. We might need to ask, what do these contain? What, in terms of species, how can we best ensure that whatever remains, whatever remnant populations of plants and animals are there, how can we ensure that they stay? How can we make sure that they can recolonise as the environment recovers? How can we make sure that there are unburned patches in the landscape in future? Are there attributes of the current patches that mean that they didn't burn? Were they long riparian strips? Were they in areas of lower-lying swampy grounds, so the water table was higher and the moisture prevented them from burning? Were they in topographically distinct positions? Can we learn from why these patches didn't burn and try to enhance parts of the landscape in future that will be resistant to burning or less likely to burn?
Mm. And early on when these bushfires were happening, and even now, your data has played a big part in quantifying what the losses have been. So I'm wondering, what post-bushfire is the role of ecologists like yourself?
I think we need to really strongly advocate for much, much better monitoring. So the numbers that we have for the estimates for numbers of animals killed, the estimates for the numbers of species that may lose their entire existence, they come from really general studies, not studies that have been necessarily done in the areas that are burned. And that's because we don't have good monitoring. We've had good monitoring in the past, but to a large degree that's been wound down over the years, progressively at the state level and the Commonwealth level. So the gold standard would be, if you have a disturbance, you have some monitoring in the area and some areas where the disturbance doesn't take place. You're monitoring before the disturbance, so you know what the populations are doing, what the system is doing. You go back after the disturbance, after the fire in this case, and you see what the effect has been, and you can quantify it to a much greater degree. And you can compare the change in population sizes, species composition, ecological processes and so on, before and after, and compare that also with the controls. And we don't have that ability simply because we don't have the monitoring. And one thing that will be crucial, I think, will be to get the monitoring up and running. Ideally, we should be monitoring and tracking biodiversity in every one of the bioregions in Australia, not just in the areas likely to be burned, because we know biodiversity is eroding everywhere. So we need to get some monitoring in place, I think, in every bioregion in the country. It's only 80 or so, and it might be several million dollars a year to carry that out. Mm. It's a drop in the bucket.
I find it really interesting because to your average person, monitoring seems quite like, you know, a mundane task. But recently I was chatting to David Yates from, he's an entomologist at the CSIRO, and we were talking about, you know, the Insectageddon and how Australian entomologists will find it really difficult to kind of get those numbers in Australia because there's just no monitoring, there's no data for it, and there's no money behind it. So it's so critical that, I mean, you're completely right, monitoring is so important, but it would seem really, yeah, not important when you think of the scheme of things, but it's so important.
Absolutely. And when you look at the other things that we do monitor very well, we monitor the stock exchange. You know, it's in your face every day about whether it's gone up a tick or down a tick. And really, you know, it's just going to keep going up in the long term. With biodiversity, we're pretty confident it's going down in the long term. But we don't really have any idea of whether it's going down more quickly or more slowly in particular areas. We don't have any real idea of the effects of different disturbance events. We know that generically introduced animals, introduced weeds, are having depressive effects. We know that big events like the fires are going to have very depressive effects. But in terms of real quantification, we can't do it simply because we haven't got the monitoring.
Now I'm picturing a stock exchange that for biodiversity, and I feel like that would actually be very, very effective, and we should patent that right now.
I think absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's. I think a daily report on how biodiversity is faring would be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today, Chris.
My pleasure.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Chris Dickman. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.